Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Crimea is preparing for referendum, and missing Malaysian flight prompts broader discussion of Asia airline security. I'm Bob Doty, broadcasting from Washington. The chief of Crimea's election commission, Mykhailo Malyushev, said Monday he is moving ahead with preparations for next Sunday's referendum on unification with Russia. He said all registered Crimean voters are eligible to vote. Russian forces have tightened their grip on Crimea as authorities in the breakaway territory push their plan to join Moscow. Ukraine's interim prime minister vowed Sunday not to give up a single centimeter of territory. Arseniy Yatsenyuk addressed supporters who rallied in Kiev to celebrate the 200th anniversary, or rather birthday, that is, of Ukrainian poet and national hero Taras Shevchenko. Mr. Yatsenyuk is to meet Wednesday with U.S. President Barack Obama in Washington to discuss the standoff over Crimea, a strategic peninsula in southern Ukraine with a Russian-speaking majority. It is still unclear why a Malaysia passenger jet vanished on its way to China early Saturday from Kuala Lumpur. But as authorities investigate the apparent security lapses, analysts say they should be a catalyst for bolstering airline safety in the region. VOA's Bill Eyde has more from Beijing.
The little information that has emerged from the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 has frustrated increasingly desperate families and authorities who are still searching for the plane. In Malaysia Monday, Transportation Minister Hishamuddin Bintun Hussein urged people to refrain from repeating rumors until authorities are able to verify what happened.
Because it affects our exercise of search and rescue.
Authorities continue to investigate the identities of two passengers on board the plane who were traveling with stolen passports. Bill Eyde, Beijing.
The United States is warning of consequences related to any unauthorized sales of oil that militia members have loaded onto a North Korean-flagged tanker in a Libyan port. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said in a statement late Sunday that the oil belongs to Libya's National Oil Company and its partners, which include U.S. companies. She said those who buy stolen oil could face civil action and sanctions. Libya has banned militias from selling crude oil directly to the world market. The Libyan Navy and pro-government militia sent boats Sunday to prevent the tanker from leaving the port, which is controlled by a rival militia. A group of Greek Orthodox nuns, held by rebels since December, are back in Syria, a day after being released in neighboring Lebanon. The 13 nuns and three attendants arrived early Monday in a small town near the border, about 30 kilometers northwest of Damascus. The head of their monastery said the group was treated well in captivity and thanked President Bashar al-Assad and Lebanese officials for helping secure their release. The monastery is in Ma'alula, a Christian village about 40 kilometers north of Damascus. Syrian rebels overran the village in December and seized the nuns who worked in the monastery's orphanage. Oscar Pistorius vomited in court Monday as he heard graphic testimony about the injuries sustained by his girlfriend when he fatally shot her. Pistorius was listening to testimony from the pathologist who performed the autopsy on the body of his girlfriend, model Riva Steenkamp. Prosecutors accused the Olympic athlete of murdering Steenkamp after an argument. Pistorius says he thought he was shooting at an intruder. Somali troops and African Union forces have recaptured a number of towns from al-Shabaab militants in what they say is a renewed effort to dislodge the group from its strongholds in the country. One of the areas was one of al-Shabaab's biggest bases in southern Somalia. Troops from the African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM, and the Somali National Army retook control there Sunday after a day of fighting. An AMISOM spokesman told VOA that the al-Shabaab fighters are mainly retreating when they see AMISOM forces. North Korean state media say leader Kim Jong-un has been elected to the country's highest legislative body, with 100% of the voters in his district turning out for the election and all of them casting their ballot for him. That's the news from The Voice of America. I'm Bob Doty reporting.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Somali government and African Union forces say they have recaptured territory that was held by the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. A government official says the offensive is just the start of a fresh effort to oust the group from its remaining strongholds in Somalia.
That's VOA's Gabe Joslo reporting from our East Africa Bureau in Nairobi. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, the U.S. warns of consequences related to any unauthorized sales of oil that militia members have loaded onto a North Korean-flagged tanker in a Libyan port. More than 40 African migrants drowned late yesterday in the Gulf of Aden, and a new report warns up to 1 billion people are at risk of extreme poverty by 2030. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Sudan, and our feature reports. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the United States is warning of consequences related to any unauthorized sales of oil that militia members have loaded onto a North Korean-flagged tanker in a Libyan port. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said in a statement late yesterday that the oil belongs to Libya's National Oil Company and its partners, which include U.S. companies. She said those who buy stolen oil could face civil action and sanctions. Libya has banned militias from selling crude oil directly to the world market. The Libyan Navy and pro-government militias sent boats yesterday to prevent the tanker from leaving the port, which is controlled by a rival militia. Libya's culture minister and government spokesman Habib al-Amin said every effort is being taken to stop the tanker and that a military strike is possible if it does not follow government orders. Somali government and African Union forces say they have recaptured territory that was held by the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslo reports a government official says the offensive is just the start of a fresh effort to oust the group from its remaining strongholds in Somalia.
Somali forces were supported by Ethiopian soldiers who belong to the AU force AMISOM in the operations against Al-Shabaab, which began on Friday. Somali government spokesman Abdirahman Omar Osman said soldiers retook some key towns that had been under militant control and reported no major setbacks.
So far over the weekend, we had at least five towns in Bayambokor region that Somali National Forces and AMISOM recaptured from Al-Shabaab.
Two of the towns are in the ghetto region, including Burdebo, which the VOA Somali service reports was home to one of the largest Al-Shabaab bases in southern Somalia. Residents reported hearing heavy fighting in the area on Friday, although an AMISOM spokesman told VOA Somali that Al-Shabaab fighters are mostly retreating when they see AU soldiers coming. Regional forces had been successful in driving the militants out of major cities in the past, but until the recent operations, had not reclaimed significant ground since Kenyan troops took control of the port city of Kismayo in 2012. Osman said the weekend's fighting is just the beginning of a much larger military campaign.
Our aim is to not stop this operation until we took over all the districts, all the areas that Al-Shabaab currently occupy.
To avoid power vacuums in newly liberated towns, Osman said the first priority for the government is to provide humanitarian aid, then to establish local administrations to deliver basic services. In an audio statement posted on a pro-jihadi website, Al-Shabaab leader Ahmed Abdi Godane called for Somali citizens to take up arms against foreign forces. I call upon the fighters to defend the religion and to fight against the enemies, he said. Ethiopian soldiers who have come thousands of kilometers should not outlast you. Al-Shabaab, which seeks to establish Islamic law across Somalia, continues to control territory in some parts of the country and retains the ability to wreak havoc in the capital Mogadishu as well. Last month, Al-Shabaab fighters stormed the presidential palace, Villa Somalia. The president was unharmed, but 17 people were killed. Gabe Joslo, VOA News.
More More than 40 African migrants drowned late yesterday in the Gulf of Aden when their boat capsized near Yemen's port of Bir Ali. Yemen's defense ministry reports naval personnel took 30 survivors to a refugee camp. No nationalities were given for the victims, who were apparently sailing to Yemen. Several hundred have drowned recently trying to reach Yemen. The International Organization for Migration said last year more than 7,000 undocumented Africans died traveling by sea or crossing the Sinai Peninsula to find work on the Arabian Peninsula. Coming up on 11 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. An international commission of inquiry leaves tomorrow for the Central African Republic to begin investigating alleged human rights violations by the Seleka and anti-Balaka militias in that country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
After 3 days in the capital, Bangui, the three-member UN commission will visit the interior of the Central African Republic. During the next 2 weeks, the commissioners will investigate the scope and gravity of alleged rights violations. They say they will interview victims of abuse, witnesses to the commission of crimes, political and village leaders, anyone who can shed light on killings, rapes, disappearances, and other abuses against the civilian population. Commission Chairman Bernard Achomuna is a lawyer and advocate to the Cameroon Supreme Court. He recently returned from a visit to Bangui and says there is a total breakdown of law and order in the country.
When I was there 2 weeks ago, there was a definite feeling that this must stop, and therefore the government of transition is emphasizing that we have to put an end to impunity. But that is easier said than done. What we can do is make sure that those who cross the red line would be accountable to the international community and would be liable to prosecutions if necessary.
At the request of the UN Security Council, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon established the commission in January for an initial period of 1 year. Its mandate is to investigate reports of human rights abuses in the Central African Republic by all parties since January 2013. Commissioner Muna says the commission will explore every avenue of concern throughout the country.
We have to see the camps where people are interned. We have to talk to people in the villages. We have to have a feel of the menace that they have faced. We have to have a feel of what they went through in order to advise the Security Council correctly. We have to know what's going on.
In recent months, tens of thousands of Muslims have fled their homes in Western CAR, fearing attacks by the largely Christian anti-Balaka group. Muna says he views genocide as a serious possibility, and the international community must not wait until genocide has been committed before taking action.
My experience in Rwanda shows that genocide starts always with propaganda, convincing the population that this group of people are evil, they are bad, they should be eliminated.
The commission will present an interim report of its findings to the Security Council in June, followed by a final report at the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Climbing out of extreme poverty and staying there can be very difficult. A new report warns up to 1 billion people are at risk of extreme poverty by 2030 unless more is done to support them in hard times. VOA's Joe DiCapua has details.
Unemployment, poor health, high food prices, conflict, and natural disasters. These are some of the things that can drive people below the poverty line of $1.25 a day. The Overseas Development Institute and the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network have released the third Chronic Poverty Report. Network Director Andrew Shepherd, the lead author, warns of poverty's revolving door.
People fall into poverty as well as escape it, and once they've escaped it, they can fall back in again.
He says there are three legs of poverty that must be addressed.
You can be poor the whole of your life, chronically poor, and policies, generally speaking, don't deal very well with that. You can become poor, you can be impoverished. policies are beginning to address that a little bit better than they did 10 years ago, but there's still a long way to go on that, especially in Africa and actually also in Asia. And then once you've escaped poverty, you need to keep on in an upward trajectory. You need to keep on moving away from poverty because you can easily fall back in again.
It's estimated there were 1.2 billion people in extreme poverty in 2010. That's a decline of 700 million since 1990. Shepherd says that's good news, but the trend may not continue.
People who are chronically poor, they're poor over their lifetimes for reasons, and those reasons can be quite hard to tackle. For example, they might be discriminated against. And some countries now have good policies against discrimination, but many countries don't yet, or they don't implement them.
Shepherd says the most frequent cause for falling back below the poverty line is ill health. The report recommends three approaches to what it calls zero poverty.
The first of these is providing some sort of cash relief, if you like, cash transfers or an employment guarantee, something which provides a safety net. The second thing is a massive investment in education, because education works to help people out of poverty, to keep them going in the right direction. And education, of course, works to sustain people's escapes out of poverty, provided that you can get them up to a high enough level.
Primary and secondary education levels are a must, he says. The third step to reduce poverty is called pro-poorest economic growth.
You need jobs, of course, and those jobs can be agricultural, non-agricultural, but jobs also need to be decent. They need to pay some kind of minimum wage. That can be underpinned by an employment guarantee, and you need health and safety provisions.
The report calls on all countries to have universal health coverage and good disaster risk management to deal with the weather extremes of climate change. It also says international aid will continue to be extremely important in low-income countries. However, it adds, few donors have displayed real interest in tackling chronic poverty.
The report does an analysis which shows that there are about 44 countries who spend a total of less than $500 per person per year. That's on everything. And the report also indicates that quite a few of those countries, I think it was 19, won't be doing very much better by 2030.
Shepherd says countries also can find more money to help tackle poverty by doing a better job of collecting taxes. He says some of the success stories in reducing poverty in recent years include China, Vietnam, Brazil, Ethiopia, Nepal, and Bangladesh. The issue of chronic poverty is expected to be addressed as the international community decides how to replace the Millennium Development Goals. They come due next year. Last October, the World Bank reported the number of people living in extreme poverty had declined sharply in the past three decades. But it warned about 400 million children continue to live in what it called abysmal conditions. Bank President Jim Yong Kim said the goal of ending poverty and boosting shared prosperity can be achieved, but only if nations work together with new urgency. Those efforts, he said, must include education and health care for children. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 19 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The U.S. warns of consequences related to any unauthorized sales of oil that militia members have loaded onto a North Korean-flagged tanker in a Libyan port. Somalia's government and African Union forces say they have recaptured territory that was once held by al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab. And more than 40 African migrants drowned late yesterday in the Gulf of Aden when their boat capsized near Yemen's port of Bir Ali. And of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. In Sudanese around the continent, young South Sudanese who fled the conflict in their country, are returning to fight against the government. Hundreds have already returned and more are packing their bags. Marta van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
About 100 South Sudanese between the age of 18 and 40 have left the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa this past week, and up to 300 more are expected to leave in the coming 2 weeks. 31-year-old Gadet fled to Ethiopia 1 month ago. He is an ethnic Nuer and feared for his life in Juba, where he worked as a sales representative. Gadet says he has to go back and fight for his country on the opposition side.
I don't have country basically now. Then I had to fight for it, you know, to get back my country and to go and live there. People who are in the opposition, you know, they were part of the SPLM. And then they had wanted this SPLM internal reforms, which the president has refused. They refused to, you know, to sit together, have internal dialogues, and then discuss their problem and way forwards. And then we had to fight together with the opposition, because in the first time when this problem started, then the president refused it, this democratic transition to go forward.
More than 500 young South Sudanese have shown an interest in going back home and fight. The elders in the South Sudanese refugee communities have tried to discourage some, especially the students, saying education is more important, but their arguments are barely heard. 38-year-old James fled to Ethiopia shortly after fighting broke out in December. He received military training as a child as part of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, but never actually fought. He says he's now ready to defend his country and is scheduled to leave in 2 weeks.
The fact that the war was imposed on the majority of South Sudanese, we felt that if the leadership did not see dialogue as a mean to a peaceful solution of things, then now we have violence. So we, the population, accept war. So let us go on the field and see who is going to win this. And if we can win militarily, then we will prove whoever imposed this war on us to be wrong.
Both Gadet and James say they are going home voluntarily and have not been recruited by the opposition. The returning South Sudanese also include a few females. From Addis Ababa, they will fly to Ethiopia's southwestern region, Gambela. From there, they will cross the river into South Sudan and travel to opposition-held areas. After receiving military training and the rank, everyone will be tasked with specific duties, which include frontline fighting. Fighting in South Sudan broke out mid-December after President Salva Kiir accused his former Vice President Riek Machar of planning a coup. The East African bloc IGAD has been mediating peace talks and announced last week that a stabilization and protection force should be sent to South Sudan. Gadet says he does not support the intervention of foreign troops and doubts their credibility.
Why are they collecting troops? In that case, you will be questioning how is this troop going to be neutral? Because if you put them on the oil field, then why they're protecting oil fields? It means they are also strengthening the government that has killed its own people.
Peace negotiations between the two fighting parties have made little progress. Although two agreements were signed in January, including a cessation of hostilities, fighting continues and the talks have been postponed till late March. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
South Africa's education minister says the nation of 11 official languages will introduce Mandarin into its school curriculum. The move is part of a greater effort to get closer to major trading partner China and has been criticized as well as welcomed. VOA's Anita Powell asked if this nation of linguists is ready for Chinese.
If you want to say hello in South Africa, you have no shortage of options in this nation of 11 official languages. It's Sawubona in Zulu, Hello in Afrikaans, and Dumelang in Setswana. And of course, there is always Hello. But now, South Africa's education ministry hopes to add another language to this polyglot nation by saying Ni Hao to Mandarin Chinese. An agreement this month between the two nations focuses on five areas of cooperation: curriculum development, math and science, teacher training, vocational education, and research and development in basic education. Ministry of Basic Education spokeswoman Troy Martens says the new partnership is extremely valuable to both countries, though officials have not said how much the initiative will cost.
It's very exciting because it takes the relationship between South Africa and China beyond just trade relations and into issues of mutual development for both of our developing countries. So it's very exciting, and both countries have indicated that for them education is a high priority. And that's why education is high on the agenda of collaboration between the two countries.
The aspect of the plan that has garnered the most attention is a plan to roll out Mandarin language in South African schools. South Africans have mixed feelings about China, according to a Pew study last year that showed that 46% of South Africans said they did not like the spread of Chinese ideas and customs in their country. And 60% of South Africans say they dislike Chinese music, movies, and television. But Martin said the market trumps those feelings.
China is South Africa's biggest trading partner, so it is extremely beneficial for learners in South Africa to be exposed to the Mandarin language as well as Chinese culture. Now, this won't be compulsory, it won't be for every school, and it won't be for every child, but for schools that feel they have the capacity to offer Mandarin as a subject, we think it's a great opportunity for South African learners to be exposed to this international type of language.
South Africa's census does not say how many native Chinese speakers there are in this country of nearly 51 million people, though they are likely somewhere within the 830,000 South Africans who told census takers their first language was not among the 12 most popular. Principal Lisette Noonan heads the Pretoria Chinese School, a kindergarten to grade 12 private school of about 500 students in the capital, Pretoria. Every student studies Mandarin. Noonan says the school, which has been around for 80 years, welcomes the new collaboration between the two nations.
We were quite excited by the announcement. We do believe that it is in the best interest of our children to know the Mandarin, especially with China becoming such a huge economic power in the world.
South African schools suffer from the legacy of apartheid, which just two decades ago intentionally gave inferior education to the majority of the population. China has in that time drastically expanded its education system, and last year the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development ranked students in Shanghai as the world's top scorers in reading, science, and mathematics. South Africa hopes the alliance will not only better South African students, but also bring them some of China's success. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people. Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The U.S. warns of consequences related to any unauthorized sales of oil that militia members have loaded onto a North Korean-flagged tanker in a Libyan port. Somalia's government and African Union forces say they have recaptured territory that was held by the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. And more than 40 African migrants drowned late yesterday in the Gulf of Aden when their boat capsized near Yemen's port of Bir Ali. Coming up, music from South Sudan and part one of our new feature series on China in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand African athletics tops your sports report this evening.
Kim, our starting line on the sunny side of sports is African athletics. Athletes from Ethiopia, Kenya, and Djibouti won gold medals over the weekend at the IAAF World Indoor Championships in Poland. In the men's 800 meters final, an Ethiopian runner won his second consecutive world indoor title, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Ethiopian defending champion Mohamed Aman retained his 800-meter title at the World Indoor Championships in Sopot, Poland on Sunday. Kenyan Caleb Mwangangi Ndiku and Ethiopian Dejen Gebremeskel claimed gold and bronze medals respectively in the men's 3,000 meters. In the women's version of the event, Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba and Kenyan defending champion Helen Onsando Obiri made it a 1-2 African triumph, while Ivory Coast's Muriela Hore clinched a silver medal in the women's 60 meters in her second consecutive outing at this biannual event. Staying in Sopot, Ayanla Suleiman won the men's 1500 meters to hand Djibouti their first ever medal at a World Indoor Championships on Saturday. Ethiopian Aman Wote and Moroccan defending champion Abdelati Igida followed to secure an African medal podium sweep. Little-known Ethiopian Aksumawit Embai was a surprise women's 1500-meter silver medalist. Ethiopia finished third overall with 2 gold, 2 silver, and 1 bronze medal. Kenya is 10th, Djibouti 14th, Ivory Coast 24th, and Morocco 26th out of 27 countries on the medal table. Voice of
America. The United States topped the medals table at the World Indoor Championships in Poland. The Americans finished with 8 gold, 2 silver, and 2 bronze for a total of 12 medals, more than twice as many medals as runner-up Russia. The Russians had 3 gold and 2 silver and 5 medals. Ethiopia also had 5 medals total. But because the Russians won 3 gold to Ethiopia's 2, Russia finished ahead because gold has more weight in the final standings. The United States ended the championship in record-setting fashion. In the final event of the 3-day competition, the USA's 4x400-meter relay team set a new world indoor record, clocking 3 minutes, 2.13 seconds. The 4 American athletes handling the baton were Kyle Clemens, David Verberg, Kine Butler, and Calvin Smith. The American relay team received a $50,000 bonus offered by the IAAF for setting a world record. Almighty Dollar, got money.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Joining us now on the Voice of America is our Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot, on the spot, Adeyemi. And Segun has a package of African club football news for us.
Good evening, Africa. Zamalek of Egypt has become the first side to reach the round of 16 of the African Champions League. Five-time winner Zamalek advanced 1-0 on aggregate after holding Angola's Kabuskop to a goalless draw on Friday. Zamalek, which last won the Champions League in 2002, will now face Zambia's Nkana FC in the round of 16. Nkana reached the round after defeating Uganda's Kampala City 2-1 on Saturday. The Zambians went through with a 4-3 aggregate victory, having played out a 2-2 draw at home to Kampala City in the first leg. However, former champion Enyimba of Nigeria and Raja Club of Morocco are the biggest casualties of the round of 32. The duo, with five titles between them, went down to unfancied opponents in the second leg matches on Saturday. Enyimba won by a lone goal against Malian challenger AS Royal in Bamako. But the Malians, 2-1 winners in the first leg in Aba, advanced on the away goal rule after a 2-2 tie. The round of 16 marks the farthest that AS Real has reached in a major continental club championship since 1966. In Casablanca, Guinean champion Roya, also a dominant force in continental club championship in the late 70s and 80s, was responsible for Raja's ouster. Striker Musin Nayajo scored the only goal of the encounter 3 minutes from time, forcing the game into penalties. Roya won 5-4. In Maputo, Knowledge Musona scored a hat-trick to inspire Kaizer Chiefs to a 3-0 win over host Liga Mukulmana of Mozambique, with the South Africans going through 7-0 on aggregates. Here now are the other results of the first-round second-leg matches. Primeiro Augusto of Angola 2, AC Leopards of Congo 0. AC Leopards reached the round of 16 with a 4-3 aggregate win. And as for Yenega of Burkina Faso 0, ES Setif of Algeria 0. ES Setif reaches the last 16 with a 5-0 aggregate win. In the CAF Confederation Cup, Tunisian club Etoile du Sahel, Bayelsa United of Nigeria, and Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosas have all reached the round of 16 following return leg matches this weekend. Etoile du Sahel beat Cara Brazzaville of Congo 3-0 to advance 3-1 on aggregates. Bayelsa United defeated Konzo of Congo 2-0 to progress by the same scoreline on aggregate, while ASEC Mimosas played 1-1 with Sekou do Bamako of Mali, but reaches the next stage 3-1 on aggregate. Also advancing are AS Kigali of Rwanda, which won 5-4 on penalties after tying 1-1 on aggregate with Ali Shandi of Sudan, Haumine of Zimbabwe, which beat St. Michel United of Seychelles 3-1 to win 6-4 on aggregate, Zesco United FC of Zambia, which defeated Ferroviário do Beira of Mozambique 1-0 for an aggregate win of the same scoreline, and Medeama of Ghana, which beat Maghreb Fest of Morocco 2-1 for a 4-2 aggregate win. Away from African club football, South African President Jacob Zuma has decided not to appoint a commission of inquiry to investigate allegations of match fixing involving the national team ahead of the 2010 FIFA World Cup. South Africa's presidency issued a statement on Friday confirming that the investigation will now be done by World Soccer's governing body, FIFA. The decision comes some 18 months after a commission had been mooted by Sports Minister Fikile Mbalula, following newspaper reports that several home friendlies played by South Africa had been fixed before the country hosted the finals. FIFA said last November it will be taking over the investigation because of government inaction, an announcement condemned by Mbalula. Thanks a lot for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Washington!
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the voice of America. In more football news, Brazil officially inaugurated a new World Cup stadium Sunday in the Amazonian city of Manaus, located in the north of the country. As part of the festivities, about 20,000 fans attended a test match between Brazilian clubs Nacional and Remo. The Arena Amazonia in Manaus has a seating capacity more than twice that of about 44,000. During the match, a rainbow appeared over the stadium, and perhaps that's a sign of better things to come for Brazil, which has had accidents, cost overruns, and delays in stadium construction in the build-up to June's World Cup. Now, the Arena Amazonia is the eighth of 12 World Cup stadiums to be officially handed over, with construction still underway in Curitiba and Sao Paulo, which will host the opening match June 12th between Brazil and Croatia. The Brazilians are in a race against time to complete stadiums, airports, communications infrastructure, as well as transportation systems with the World Cup fast approaching. During the stadium inauguration on Sunday, the deputy governor of the Amazonas, José Melo, said Brazil should be proud of the stadium, which was designed to be environmentally friendly. The pitch will recycle rainwater that will be used in stadium bathrooms, while the roof will collect the Amazonian sunlight to generate power. The first World Cup match at the Arena Amazonia will be June 14th when England goes against Italy. The only African team scheduled to play at Arena Amazonia in Manaus is Cameroon. The indomitable Lions of Cameroon will play Croatia in their second World Cup match on June 18th at Arena Amazonia. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, China's African dream and the growing use of commercial drones. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Hadia of South Sudan with Habibi.
Habibi, 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 hab
Adia with Habibi. Well, China is establishing soft power throughout Africa. It's airing a TV show dubbed in French for a Senegalese audience. High-profile leaders from Beijing come to Dakar. China is also focusing on economic partnerships, and migration is growing between China and Africa. Ricky Shryock looks at Africa's Chinese dream in a five-part series.
When asked why China has not enjoyed the same soft power Western countries have seen in Africa, researcher Sven Grimm, director of the Center for Chinese Studies at Stellenbosch University in South Africa, puts it simply.
In a very provocative answer, I would say, because they don't have Lady Gaga or Madonna.
While Chinese economic trade with Africa grew to $200 billion in 2013, up from just $10 billion in 2000, today, through cultural outreach efforts, the country is hoping to up their image in Africa. Some of the soft power outreach builds on the idea of the Chinese dream of increasing prosperity both at home and abroad. Roberto Castillo, a researcher from Lingyan University, says this policy has unofficially been around for about a decade. But since Xi Jinping was elected president last year, it became an important political slogan.
One of the things that China has been trying to do, and it seems that one of the test laboratories has been Africa, is to disseminate not only its economic investment and economic power, but also soft power.
Castillo says that when it comes to African immigrants living in China, taking part in the Chinese dream, the reality of finding economic prosperity once they arrive to the new country is often harder than imagined.
This is one of the most daring political campaigns that I've seen in a long time in China.
The upside, he adds, is in cities such as Guangzhou, Africans are mostly welcomed into the fold.
What I've seen in Guangzhou is that a great majority of people there consider that the presence of African people in Guangzhou and the presence of African people in China are beneficial to China. Whereas I know that there's a lot of suspicion about Chinese presence in Africa, right? There's a lot of Africans that think that China is very good for Africa, and then a lot of Africans that might think the opposite.
It's one thing for African migrants to seek the Chinese dream in China, but the country's reach for soft power also means the Chinese dream is being sold in Africa itself. The number of Chinese in Africa has increased over the last 20 years to an estimated 1 million people. Grimm has noted some negative attitudes in Africa regarding the increased Chinese presence and investment. Grimm says, though the Chinese dream is primarily a domestic policy, it's being used as a way to say that the Chinese and Africans have similar goals.
And it is part of selling the Chinese engagement.
Grimm says it is partially due to China's lack of an open discussion about the Chinese dream that makes it a harder sell.
In an American setting, you have an American dream and the challenge of that American dream. So you have pop stars who actually can criticize that. The Chinese dream is portrayed very much as a positive element and as a positive element only.
Currently, a Chinese TV show, known in French as Doudou et ses belles-mères, is airing for the first time in Senegal. And while it probably won't produce a Chinese Lady Gaga, it could bring Senegalese households closer to their counterparts on the other side of the globe. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Dakar.
Commercial drones, the unmanned planes doing regular tasks, are in growing use around the world. Some assignments for these unmanned aircraft might surprise you. Others will amaze you. VOA's Carolyn Presutti reports on the countries leading the way and why the United States is far behind.
Think of a drone as a flying camera, capturing pictures impossible for human pilots in large aircraft. But they do more than this and are cruising the skies in many countries with few restrictions. In England, delivering sushi as a flying waiter. In South Africa, conducting wildlife research on elephants, impalas, giraffes, and more. Over the Pacific Ocean, whale watching. In Indonesia and China, soon to transport gold. In Germany, producer Chris Kippenberger creates TV commercials for high-end cars. He spoke via Skype.
You can now keep the principal doing the natural action they're doing, and let's say start the shot from the top of a building, and that's where the drone would be flying, and you could have the drone fly down to the person.
Drones have also attracted unwanted attention. Two Canadians were jailed for more than 2 months in Egypt for filming with a drone. And Turkish police shot down this drone while it was taking pictures of protesters. In Japan, drones monitor the Fukushima nuclear power plant. And also in Japan, 90% of all crop spraying is done by drones.
During its more than two decades of use, the Armax has safely logged
over 1.8 million total hours of flight, and to our knowledge, not a single complaint for privacy.
Yamaha's Henio Arcangeli and other experts appeared before a Senate hearing about regulating drone use in the United States.
The United States, in my opinion, is not leading the commercial drone industry. It's lagging.
That's because drones can only fly in the U.S. on a limited basis and typically for research.
That's the way we do things here.
David Kirstein works on airline regulatory law.
These technologies are new. They aren't proven. Particularly, and you know, there are a lot of issues related to mixing them in with other air traffic.
Privacy advocate Leslie Harris says the laws need to protect civil liberties.
Technology outstrips law over and over and over again, and it takes years to catch up.
To get a closer look at a drone, we used Google Glass. We looked at it, it looked at us. Tony Ngo sells these drones. He says his business has grown 400% in 2 years.
We hang up the phone and let a call come.
The Federal Aviation Administration estimates 7,500 drones will fill American skies in the next 5 years, but only after it publishes regulations for the nation's drone use. Those rules are due next year, though experts doubt the deadline will be met. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A wave of deadly attacks on innocent men, women, and children in northern Nigeria shows that while under pressure from police and government troops, the Boko Haram terrorist group is still a force to be reckoned with. In recent weeks, hundreds have died in raids that may have been conducted in retaliation for the crackdown, a cowardly campaign fueled by a group exploiting local grievances to assert its influence over a peaceful and diverse population. The unspeakable violence. School children burned alive in their beds, villagers gunned down en masse as their homes are destroyed, is horrific, wrong, and has no place in our world. On February 15th, the militants stormed the village of Izgay near the border with Cameroon, killing more than 100. A few days later, the village of Bama was set ablaze, and more than 115 villagers were gunned down as they tried to flee to safety. Then, early on February 24th, again in northeastern Nigeria, militants attacked the federal government college boarding school in Bunuyadi, killing 29 teenage boys. Some burned to death in their beds after their dormitory was torched. Similar attacks since then have become almost a daily occurrence. No group has claimed responsibility for the Bunuyadi killings, but Boko Haram has attacked many schools that teach Nigeria's national curriculum, which it considers sinful. If education is a sin, what is murder? What good can come from such destruction? The people of northern Nigeria deserve to be free from violence and from terror. That's why the United States is providing counterterrorism assistance to help Nigerian authorities develop a comprehensive approach to combat the threat posed by Boko Haram, while also protecting civilians and ensuring respect for human rights. We stand with the people of northern Nigeria in their struggle against violent extremism and remain a committed partner of the Nigerian government as it works to root out Boko Haram and associated groups.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.